Thumbs up.
Thumbs up.
Go ahead and call back in the order to take up item, oh gosh, which one is this? Old business, item number one. The Kidder Creek Orchard Camp Zone Change Z-1401 and Use Permit UP-1115. And this was continued from previous meeting. And at that time, we closed with the note to reopen public hearing. So we will treat this as if we are seeing it for the first time as far as procedure goes. And there will be public hearing. First off will be staff giving an updated report, and then we will follow the protocol as is found in the agenda. So with that, Ms. Lang, I relinquish the mic to you.
Thank you. Haley Lang, Planning Director. Staff's created a brief presentation, so I'll wait for Rachel to pull that up.
It's being slow. Happening today, but it's like PowerPoint just shut down for some reason. Okay, it's reopening.
We need to call IT.
It is being really, really slow.
Should I call them?
Is that the phone line?
It's just. There you go. I'm beginning. Okay.
Great. So this item is for the Kidder Creek Orchard Camp Zone Change and Use Permit project. Next slide. This project includes a zone change to rezone approximately 170 acres from timber production to rural residential, and a use permit to increase the allowable occupancy at the camp from 165 guests to a total occupancy of 844, increase the physical size of the camp from 333 to 580 acres, and the addition of structures and residential, recreational features, including a pond and ancillary facilities. It's anticipated that the expansion would occur over a 20-year period. This act also includes the revocation of the previous use permits to consolidate all the approved uses into a single use permit and an environmental impact report. This project is located at 2700 South Kidder Creek Road, west of the community of Greenview. Next slide. A little difficult to see, but this is the proposed master site plan, which includes all of the proposed features of the camp. Next slide. So at the August 17th Planning Commission meeting, this item was heard for discussion, and there was a very lengthy and robust discussion that occurred. There was presentation of the project by staff, public comment, which included comments in opposition and support of the project were a big bulk of that meeting. Commission discussed the project, the draft environmental impact report, and certain issues related to access, fire, noise, and water. And so this presentation today is just really a recap of the project. I'm not going to try to rehash all of the mitigation measures and things like that were discussed in length at the August meeting. And so since this project is a discretionary project, this project is required to be analyzed under the California Environmental Quality Act, also known as CEQA. So CEQA is intended to inform government decision makers and the public about the potential environmental effects of proposed activities and to prevent significant avoidable environmental damage. CEQA seeks to accomplish 5 major objectives, which include 1, disclose environmental impacts, 2, prevent or reduce environmental damage, 3, disclose agency decisions, 4, promote interagency coordination, and 5, encourage public participation. This process is intended to be objective, using the best data readily available, and this process also uses factual, scientific, and reputable data. Next slide. So this project has gone through many iterations of environmental review. Back in September 2016, an initial study and mitigated negative declaration was released for public review in September of 2016. Based on the comments from that process, staff and the county as the lead agency decided to elevate that to an EIR review. So a draft environmental impact report was released in September of 2019. There was then a partial recirculation of the EIR in April of 2022, and then also in June of 2022 there was a second partial recirculated EIR, which further brought forth additional information within the report. The draft EIR was released in August of 2022. And the final EIR was completed in November and released, and that is the document included in the staff report package today. In terms of mitigation measures, there was one mitigation measure that had been added after the August 17th Planning Commission meeting, and that is mitigation measure 4.7 related to biological resources. This was a mitigation measure that was strongly recommended by CDFW in their recent comment letter, and so I just wanted to highlight that on this slide today for potential commission discussion. Mitigation measure 4.7 is similar to 4.5, and 4.7 reads that a no disturbance buffer of 150 feet from the edge of a bank, edge of the floodplain, or outer edge of the riparian drip line shall be established to the specifications of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. The project shall result in no net loss of riparian habitat. Next slide. So through this environmental analysis, noise was evaluated, and through that it was identified that the project would generate substantial permanent increase in ambient noise levels, and that the project, when considered with future development, is likely to have a significant cumulative impact due to traffic noise sources. So both of these were noted as significant and unavoidable. Next slide. And so, through the CEQA process, when there are environmental areas that are noted as significant and unavoidable, the lead agency and the government decision makers have a few options. One being that the decision making agency write findings related to a document called the Statement of Overriding Considerations. And so what that does is it basically is a written document which is in the format of a resolution along with an attached fact of findings located in your staff report package. But essentially it identifies that a statement such as, you know, we as the lead agency are very aware that there is an environmental area that is significant and unavoidable, but based on, you know, project impacts, you know, and benefits to the community and project benefits, we are still certifying this EIR document. And so staff has prepared that resolution and that attachment facts of findings for you for discussion and consideration today. And recommendation. So we are recommending that the use permit be conditionally approved, that the zone change recommend to the Board of Supervisors that the zone change request be approved, as well as recommending for the board to certify the final EIR, as well as recommending to the board to accept and approve the statement of overriding considerations. Those conclude my comments, but I do also want to note, you know, through this environmental analysis, you know, wildfire is analyzed under CEQA, but the project applicant, knowing that that kind of is a concern with the community, they did create a PowerPoint today related to their fire emergency plan, and along with kind of their coordination with CAL FIRE, so they have something prepared for you all today. So I just wanted to make that noted. And we do have CAL FIRE in the stands, as well as other technical consultants that worked on the EIR for any questions you may have. And lastly, I wanted to note we did receive a comment letter late last night from the law office of Marsha Birch. So County Council has looked at that, and they also have a response to those concerns as well.
Who has a response?
County Council.
So, Council, do you want to hold off on response to the letter until a later point, or would you like to address that letter at this time?
I'll address the letter at this time.
Okay.
And first of all, I don't have a response to all the points. I just got this letter. Many substantive points were raised at the end of the letter that I had no chance to review. Let me just comment on a couple of procedural things. I guess the one is the main point the letter raises the issue regarding a draft mitigated negative declaration was done, and ultimately Kidder Creek went ahead with the EIR to address certain areas that were still potentially significant. I will note that in regards to this issue, Ms. Birch states that CEQA doesn't allow for a combined document. There's no such thing as combined MND EIR. And I'll note she cites to a case called Farmland Protection Alliance versus County of Yolo. And in the facts of that case, the County of Yolo approved a mitigated negative declaration. And it got challenged, and it went to the trial court, and the trial court said, you know, there is one area that should have EIR level analysis. And the trial court stated, you need to do an EIR for that area of analysis. And it was appealed to the appellate court, who said, well, you've already got an approved MND mitigated negative declaration. But, and then the trial courts ordered this EIR on this one subject area, and the appellate court said you can't have a mitigated negative declaration in the EIR. And the trial court's going to go with an EIR, then the whole thing needs to be an EIR. And she's relying on that case, and that's not the situation here. We do have a mitigated negative declaration, but it's only in draft form. Essentially, it's a glorified initial staff study, and I characterize it that way because in their comments to a similar letter from Scott Valley, Keep Scott Valley Rural, that was done with the draft EIR. The draft EIR noted the same concern, and the response was that there was a case, which is City of Santa Cruz versus Ocean Street Extension Neighborhood, where essentially in that case they identified the public agency certain areas that could be mitigated with their initial staff study, and then proceeded only to do an EIR on on those that weren't necessarily mitigated. And so that project was appealed, saying the ISS identified certain areas that need to be mitigated. Those should have been included in the EIR as well, along with those that were in the EIR. And that court held that it was okay if the initial staff study indicated that there were areas that were mitigated or could be mitigated that would not leave any question of significant environmental impact. And even though they were addressed as sort of outside the EIR and the initial staff study as being mitigated in a certain way, they did not have to be included in the EIR. And so to the extent, this is all very procedural and esoteric, I understand, but I am looking at the comments to comment letter number 148, where the same issue was raised by the same group, although by a different attorney. And the response was, this case says we can. And, you know, it's not perhaps typically a normal procedure that I'm aware of to do it this way, but it does seem certainly legally valid that we can proceed this way and defensible. Basically, I guess, if I could summarize in two sentences, they're saying we can't have a draft mitigated negative declaration and do an EIR. On the other side, we do have a case that says we can have mitigated measures and leave those aside and deal only those with questionable significant environmental effects in the EIR. So I believe there is case law to proceed the way we're doing.
Okay, as long as we're on this topic, my question for you specifically raised in this letter, can you expand or provide your knowledge on item C, can you clarify the importance of what this attorney, I guess before I go there, is Keep Scott Valley Rural Association a legal entity? Do you know?
Not that I'm aware of, it could be an unincorporated association that's informal.
Do you know if it's one or two people or 200 people?
I have no idea.
I'm from Scott Valley, and I see this, and to my knowledge, I don't know anybody that's part of it. That's why I ask.
I have no idea.
Okay. So, moving to item C, where the attorney brings up questions regarding project-level EIR and program EIRs and focused EIR. Could you explain the concern that may be brought up here, or is it not a concern?
I don't see it as a concern. Basically, it's a matter of terminology, and in Section C, she states, our findings refer to Section 15168, which applies to program EIRs, and this is not a program EIR, and I read that comment, and I realized we should have referred to 15161, which is just for ordinary project EIRs. And to the extent we were going to get that far, I'm just going to say we should just correct that section number so it correctly reads that it's a simple project. The CEQA section refers to a program EIR, which this is not. A program EIR is essentially where you're going to have a series of projects and there's a master EIR, and that's not the case here. This is a standalone project. And to the sense we're arguing over focused EIR or not, the EIR is the EIR. I believe we are presenting, not I believe, we are presenting the EIR as an EIR as necessary for the significant environmental effects that potentially this project could present. And a rose is a rose by any other name. It's a project level EIR. We'll correct the section number. But.
And you said that change is 15168 to 15161?
Yes.
Anything else you'd like to add on that one?
No.
Okay. There are other issues, questions I have on this, but they will wait until later. Any other questions for council at this time, strictly dealing with this letter, with what he's covered?
Just a question here on the last paragraph before Section A, the last sentence. Says the EIR response to comments also sheds lights on the fact that the project is inconsistent with federal habitat improvement plans along Kidder Creek. Well, you're over there, you've been involved in all this water stuff, and I have too for 32 years on the Shasta side. I've never seen any federal plans anywhere. You?
This was one I was going to bring up later, but since you opened the door. No, there, to my knowledge, there is none. So what is this in reference to? That's why my question is, you've replied that the association is not a formal entity
that I'm
recognized by the state. I couldn't find them. And I don't know who, let alone how many entities or individuals are part of this. There is no federal habitat plan that I know of.
I'm going to go back 15 years here under the state Coho recovery plan. There was a specific section.
Yes.
Called the Shasta Scott Recovery Plan,
correct.
Which Mr. Fowle and I were both a party to. And to my knowledge, that thing's never been approved or adopted by anybody.
No,
it's just a big old document sitting on a shelf somewhere.
Yes.
So to claim, so please correct me if I'm wrong, if there's some federal law that created some guidance to establish these plans by NOAA or by U.S. Fish and Wildlife and or Cal Fish and Game that have put together any of these plans, I've never seen them.
Okay.
And if you're going to do that, is that on federal property or is that on private property? And where's the requirement for it to be implemented on private property?
Well, I would have to leave that to the maker of the comment or the present to explain that, because I don't, and as I say, I've just seen this letter.
Is Ms. Birch here in the audience? Is Ms. Birch on the phone? Okay, silence is deafening. Other questions, comments?
Oh, I go ahead. I'm fine.
Well, I'm trying to keep us focused here and head down the path. So, questions for council.
I could go down 20 different rabbit trails here if I wanted to.
This may not be the time. If we, as a planning commission, have to post the agenda and all its contents at a given time, why are people allowed to send written correspondence the day before the meeting?
I suppose because...
How do they expect us to answer this when we get it the day before the meeting?
I'll take that as a rhetorical statement.
Thank you.
All right, so as far... We have a staff report. Council has chimed in on the letter that we've been speaking of. Haley, you mentioned that the project proponent...
Mm-hmm.
has a prepared presentation specifically related to questions brought up in August
mm-hmm.
pertaining to the potential wildfire risk.
Yep.
So, council, coming to you here, am I breaking the law if I allow for that presentation to be done now before we move into the public comments, as it is an item requested to be prepared and presented? Would it be appropriate to do that right now?
It would be appropriate, and I'll just generally comment, as the chairman, you have actually quite a bit of latitude on how long people speak in the order of presentation of evidence. I know in our agenda it says 5 minutes per speaker, and that's a general guideline. You're free to expand or reasonably contract that as you see fit, and you want to choose the call somebody and let them speak longer. That is your prerogative.
Okay.
Including when they do it.
So unless there is opposition with the commission, at this time I would ask that the project proponent limited to the presentation on the wildfire issue. Nothing beyond that scope. As long as we're clear on that, I will ask you to come forward, do that presentation, and then we'll continue with the itemized agenda.
I do have a handout that will go with the presentation. Would you like me to bring those?
Please.
Up? Yeah.
Thank you.
Did you provide copies for staff? Because I need one for the file.
There's two more.
Thank you. Yeah. Haley, do you have this?
Commissioners, thank you for allowing to come back on this subject that did come up at the last meeting in August.
Could you say your name and your address, please?
My name is Andy Workin, and I am at 2333 South Kidder Creek Road in Greenview. And again, thank you for allowing us to come back and kind of present some of the information that we have continued to work on since the last meeting. As you know, as part of the initial draft, there was a copy of our emergency plans included in that. That plan has not changed significantly. There have been a few minor little changes, but we do have a lot more information that has kind of helped us to say, yes, that was a good plan. So the outline for where we're going to go in our presentation this morning is the big question, CAL FIRE consultation, fire simulation modeling, prevention and safeguarding, wildland fire emergency plan for Kidder Creek Camp, benefits to community, and conclusion. So the big question is, when you have a fire, will you be able to keep everyone safe? And so we have spent significant amount of time since our last meeting, many consultation meetings with CAL FIRE. I'll talk about that in a moment here, but we kind of started with a couple of documents, the Red Book being one. It's an interagency fire standards for fire and aviation operations. There's a copy of the cover of that in your document there. And then the Incident Response Pocket Guide, the IRPG, which is put out by the National Fire Coordinating Group. These documents were very useful in kind of getting us started down the right path, some good, useful information. But I just want to make it clear that those documents are written for firefighters, which we are not. And so just wanted to make sure that they were good in the sense of getting us started, but they are written to firefighters, and we are not firefighters. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go. So since our last meeting, we have had multiple conversations. We've had on-site visits, tours, and review of our fire emergency plan by CAL FIRE. Through their review and on-site consultation, they agree, and they are here to back that up today, that we meet the requirements of PRC 4290, outlined and defined through the EIR process. Our wildland fire emergency plan is a good, workable plan for evacuation, and our safety zone for sheltering in place is of ample size if needed. Just want to make it clear on that last slide there that we are within the state responsibility area in the WUI, the wildland urban interface under CAL FIRE jurisdiction. And so we felt it was appropriate to consult with them on this, on our fire evacuation plan. So one of the things that came up in the last meeting was that we need to have more information about what does the fire do. If there's a fire started, what is that going to look like? What kind of time do we have? Things like that. And so we were able to run some fire simulations. We ran multiple different simulations. Some were kind of normal situations, and then we also ran catastrophic scenarios to kind of see what those would look like. So multiple and typical start points, and these were run using the CAL FIRE Wildfire Analyst simulation system. So the first simulations that we ran were under normal conditions. This year, on July 30th, the Shackelford Fire was started. So when we ran these first simulations, we used conditions similar to what we would have seen during that fire. That fire was contained on August 5th. It grew to 31 acres. The start location of that fire was was mid-slope, afternoon lightning strike with normal weather patterns for a day in August. So kind of at the edge of the wilderness. Speaking with CAL FIRE, the experts, they said, they gave me a percentage, but I think 80%, they can clarify that later. Most of our fires are kind of starting within that range where we saw this one start, and also within that time frame, kind of early to mid-afternoon. These simulations were run using a 24-hour period. They were run using a 24-hour period because within 24 hours, with both of those simulations that were run, the fire was still more than 3 to 4 miles from the edge of the border of the camp. We then ran another kind of normal, you know, simulation, but with a westerly wind, so a wind that's blowing towards the camp. Typical wind speeds of 3 to 8 miles an hour. Start location being the same. In that simulation, it was run using an 8-hour period, because in the 8-hour period, obviously with the winds blowing towards the camp, the fire was coming closer to the camp, but the fire was still 3 to 4 miles away after 8 hours. Then we ran some catastrophic situations or some scenarios. So they had to force the system to, you know, kind of come up with some of these scenarios because they were not normal. And we did a 20-mile-an-hour constant wind in one direction blowing straight at the camp. This first simulation was on the south side of the Kidder Creek drainage at 1 p.m. start. You know, typical start by a lightning strike in the mid-afternoon. Under these conditions, the simulation shows that it would likely take between 4 and 8 hours for the fire to reach the safety zone. And we'll talk more about the safety zone later. This model shows, you know, there's been some concern about the Woolly Creek drainage. This would be, you know, a model that would show kind of the fire coming from Woolly Creek and up and over South Kidder Creek on the south side there of the Kidder Creek. So this does take into account that drainage from that direction. The second simulation was run on the north side of Kidder Creek, similar start, strong winds blowing in the direction of camp. Again, we found that it's going to take between 4 and 8 hours before the fire reaches the safety zone. These next two simulations, also a catastrophic situation, but you know, fire's not always started by lightning. And so we ran some simulations showing what if somebody started a fire, you know, as they're mowing their lawn or using a chainsaw, somebody has a fire that gets out of control. This one was on the Valley Pines. 20-mile-an-hour winds, again, blowing straight towards the camp. In this simulation, it would take over 8 hours for the fire to reach the safety zone area. The second one was a residential area fire start in Greenview. And in this scenario, this is the likely kind of worst case scenario of what we would see. And it, you know, the fire could reach the camp safety zone in as little as 2 to 4 hours. I want to point out that all of those simulations were run without any suppression tactics from CAL FIRE whatsoever. So that's just the fire doing its thing, no CAL FIRE intervention at all. So with CAL FIRE using suppression tactics, that just gives us more time to be able to get out and evacuate. So our fire simulation's conclusion, under normal conditions, there's ample time for evacuation. We did have a fire in 2014. We did implement our evacuation plan at that time. We evacuated smoothly, it was orderly, it was no kind of panic, and it was at the suggestion or at the word from CAL FIRE or the Forest Service at that time saying, we recommend that you evacuate at this time. So we have done an evacuation, we've put this plan into effect already, and it went well. Under catastrophic conditions, in all but the very worst case scenario, we have ample time for a 2-hour evacuation. The 2-hour time mark is going to be significant when we get a little bit later, talk a little bit more about our evacuation plan. So again, the chance of those catastrophic conditions are very low. Obviously, we know that they do exist. We've seen some of that here just recently. But we had to force the system to kind of come up with some of those. And again, those simulations showing the fire getting to camp were without any kind of suppression tactics. So prevention and safeguarding, we're not just sitting back. Obviously, we've got a robust evacuation plan that we work on. We meet with CAL FIRE, we'll talk about that. But what are we doing to prevent and safeguard the camp, as well as people down the road from us? So we are actively managing fuel and doing fuel reduction work, especially along roadways, program areas, and around the safety zone. That's something that Tim, our facilities manager, and his team, they're constantly, consistently working on doing thinning and clearing along those areas. We have been in collaboration with our neighbors for fuel reduction and fire break projects. One was just completed a couple years ago to the south and west of kind of where we are at the camp there. We have a CFIP, which is a California Forest Improvement Program, Forest Management Plan. We are working currently with Dan Larrabee. He is our forester. And we have applications for funding for key projects as designated through our plan. There's a copy of the kind of 5 designated kind of key areas that we want to work on first, as well as some information about that CFIP in your packet. We manage defensible spaces around all buildings and in program areas, and we receive yearly inspections and review of the fire emergency plan by the fire by the local fire chief. So now kind of getting more into our emergency plan, as mentioned through the Red Book and some of these other documents, we could this acronym of LCES, Lookout, Communication, Escape Route, which we will call Evacuation, and Safety Zone, were some of the key findings. Those areas, without us knowing it, those things were already part of our plan that we had presented to you all as in August. So L is for lookout. There are multiple managed lookout sites watching for fire starts in our area. The most pertinent one to us is the Doozle Rock, which is managed by CAL FIRE, and being the main lookout, which has a clear view of the Kidder Creek drainage. In addition to that, all of our staff, as we work with children, all of our staff are safety is a huge part of what we do. We want to make sure that we're keeping kids safe when they're there at camp. And so we do training for our staff to keep the big eye. The big eye means that I'm responsible for these kids right here, but I'm keeping the big eye to kind of look around and see, are there other situations, are there other things happening that I need to be aware of to make sure that I'm keeping these kids safe. That would include fire. Communication, we use apps. We constantly monitor those as fires, come through or storms come through. We're able to track those and keep alert of what's going on. We have county alert systems that we have downloaded on our phones, cell phones to communicate with outside resources as well as with on-site staff. We have an alarm system in place to alert staff and campers of an emergency situation. And we also use handheld radios for on-site coordination.